Chapter 3. The sense of beauty and gentleness, of moral beauty and faithful gentleness, grew upon him as the clear evening closed in. When he went to visit his relative at Putney, he still carried with him his work, and the books he more immediately wanted. Although his bodily powers had been giving way, his most conspicuous qualities, his memory for books, and his affection remained. And when his hair was white, when his ample chest had grown slender, when the very proportion of his height had visibly lessened, his step was still ready, and his dark eyes brightened at every happy expression, and at every thought of kindness. His death was simply exhaustion. He broke off his work, to lie down and repose. So gentle was the final approach, that he scarcely recognized it till the very last, and then it came without terrors. His physical suffering had not been severe. At the latest hour he said, that his only uneasiness was failing breath, and that failing breath was used to express his sense of the inexhaustible kindness he had received from the family who had been so unexpectedly made his nurses, to draw from one of his sons, by minute, eager, and searching questions, all that he could learn about the latest vicissitudes and growing hopes of Italy, to ask the friends and children around him for news of those whom he loved, and to send love and messages to the absent who loved him. Thus, with a manly simplicity and filial affection, writes the eldest son of Leigh Hunt in recording his father's death. These are the closing words of a new edition of the autobiography of Leigh Hunt, published by Messrs. Smith and Elder, of Cornhill, revised by that son, and enriched with an introductory chapter of remarkable beauty and tenderness. The son's first presentation of his father to the reader, rather tall, straight as an arrow, looking slenderer than he really was, his hair black and shining, and slightly inclined to wave, his head high, his forehead straight and white, his eyes black and sparkling, his general complexion dark, in his whole carriage and manner an extraordinary degree of life, completes the picture. It is the picture of the flourishing and fading away of man, that is born of a woman and hath but a short time to live. In his presentation of his father's moral nature and intellectual qualities, Mr. Hunt is no less faithful, and no less touching. Those who knew Leigh Hunt will see the bright face, and hear the musical voice again, when he is recalled to them in this passage. Even at seasons of the greatest depression in his fortunes, he always attracted many visitors, but still not so much for any repute that attended him as for his personal qualities. Few men were more attractive, in society, whether in a large company, or over the fireside. His manners were peculiarly animated. His conversation, varied, ranging over a great field of subjects, was moved and called forth by the response of his companion, be that companion philosopher or student, sage or boy, man or woman, and he was equally ready for the most lively topics or for the gravest reflections, his expression easily adapting itself to the tone of his companion's mind. With much freedom of manners, he combined a spontaneous courtesy that never failed, and a considerateness derived from a ceaseless kindness of heart that invariably fascinated even strangers. Or in this, his animation, his sympathy with what was gay and pleasurable, his avowed doctrine of cultivating cheerfulness, were manifest on the surface, and could be appreciated by those who knew him in society, most probably even exaggerated as salient traits, on which he himself insisted with a sort of gay and ostentatious willfulness. The last words describe one of the most captivating peculiarities of a most original and engaging man, better than any other words could. The reader is besought to observe them, for a reason that shall presently be given. Lastly, the anxiety to recognize the right of others, the tendency to refine, which was noted by an early school companion, and the propensity to elaborate every thought, made him, along with the direct argument by which he sustained his own conviction, recognize and almost admit all that might be said on the opposite side. For these reasons, and for others suggested with equal felicity, and with equal fidelity, the Son writes of the Father, it is most desirable that his qualities should be known as they were, for such deficiencies as he had are the honest explanation of his mistakes, while, as the reader may see from his writings and his conduct, they are not, as the faults of which he was accused would be, incompatible with the noblest faculties both of head and heart. To know Li Hun as he was to hold him in reverence and love. These quotations are made here, with a special object. It is not that the personal testimony of one who knew Li Hun well may be borne to their truthfulness. It is not that it may be recorded in these pages, as in his son's introductory chapter, that his life was of the most amiable and domestic kind, that his wants were few, that his way of life was frugal, that he was a man of small expenses, no ostentations, a diligent laborer, and a secluded man of letters. It is not that the inconsiderate and forgetful may be reminded of his wrongs and sufferings in the days of the regency and of the national disgrace of his imprisonment. It is not that their forbearance may be entreated for his grave, in right of his graceful fancy, or his political labors and endurances, though, not only we, the latest seed of time, knew men, that in the flying of a wheel cry down the past, not only we, that great of rights and wrongs, have loved the people well. It is that a duty may be done in the most direct way possible. An act of plain, clear duty. 4 or 5 years ago, the writer of these lines was much pained by accidentally encountering a printed statement that Mr. Li Hun was the original of Harold Skimpole in Bleak House. The writer of these lines is the author of that book. The statement came from America. It is no disrespect to that country, in which the writer has, perhaps, as many friends, and as true an interest as any man that lives, good-humoredly to state the fact that he has, now and then, been the subject of paragraphs in transatlantic newspapers, more surprisingly destitute of all foundation in truth than the wildest delusions of the wildest lunatics. For reasons born of this experience, he let the thing go by. But, since Mr. Li Hun's death, the statement has been revived in England. The delicacy and generosity evinced in its revival are for the rather late consideration of its revivers. The fact is this. Exactly those graces and charms of manner which are remembered in the words we have quoted, were remembered by the author of the work of fiction in question, when he drew the character in question. Above all other things, that sort of gay and ostentatious willfulness in the humoring of a subject, which had many a time delighted him, and impressed him as being unspeakably whimsical and attractive, was the airy quality he wanted for the man he invented. Partly for this reason, and partly he has since often grieved to think, for the pleasure it afforded him to find that delightful manner reproducing itself under his hand, he yielded to the temptation of too often making the character speak like his old friend. He no more thought, God forgive him, that the admired original would ever be charged with the imaginary vices of the fictitious creature, than he has himself ever thought of charging the blood of Desdemona and Othello on the innocent Academy model who sat for Iago's leg in the picture. Even as to the mere occasional manner, he meant to be so cautious and conscientious, that he privately referred the proof sheets of the first number of that book to two intimate literary friends of Li Hun, both still living, and altered the whole of that part of the text on their discovering too strong a resemblance to his way. He cannot see the son lay this wreath on the father's tomb, and leave him to the possibility of ever thinking that the present words might have righted the father's memory, and were left unwritten. He cannot know that his own son may have to explain his father, when folly or malice can wound his heart no more, and leave this task undone. The Tlesnival bleeder, the pen is taken in hand on the present occasion, by a private individual not wholly unaccustomed to literary composition, for the exposure of a conspiracy of a most frightful nature, A conspiracy which, like the deadly Abastria of Java, on which the individual produced a poem in his earlier youth, not wholly devoid of length, which was so flatteringly received in circles not wholly unaccustomed to form critical opinions, that he was recommended to publish it, and would certainly have carried out the suggestion, but for private considerations not wholly unconnected with expense. The individual who undertakes the exposure of the gigantic conspiracy now, to be laid bare in all its hideous deformity, is an inhabitant of the town of Tlesnival, a lowly inhabitant, it may be, but one who, as an Englishman and a man, will never abase his eye before the gaudy and the mocking throng. Tlesnival stoops to demand no championship from her sons. On an occasion in history, our bluff British monarch, our 8th Royal Harry, almost went there. And long ere the periodical in which this exposure will appear had sprung into being, Tlesnival had unfurled that standard which yet waves upon her battlements. The standard alluded to is the Tlesnival Bleeder, containing the latest intelligence and state of markets, down to the hour of going to press, and presenting a favorable local medium for advertisers, on a graduated scale of charges, considerably diminishing in proportion to the guaranteed number of insertions. It were bootless to expatiate on the host of talent engaged in formidable phalanx, to do fealty to the Bleeder. Suffice it to select, for present purposes, one of the most gifted, and, but for the wide and deep ramifications of an un-English conspiracy, most rising, of the men who are bold Albion's pride. It were needless, after this preamble, to point the finger more directly at the London correspondent of the Tlesnival Bleeder. On the weekly letters of that correspondent, on the flexibility of their English, on the boldness of their grammar, on the originality of their quotations, never, to be found as they are printed, in any book existing, on the priority of their information, on their intimate acquaintance with the secret thoughts and unexecuted intentions of men, it would ill become the humble Tlesnivellian who traces these words, to dwell. They are graven in the memory, they are on the Bleeder's file. Let them be referred to. But from the infamous, the dark, the subtle conspiracy which spreads its baleful roots throughout the land, and of which the Bleeder's London correspondent is the one sole subject, it is the purpose of the lowly Tlesnivellian who undertakes this revelation, to tear the veil. Nor will he shrink from his self-imposed labor, Herculean though it be. The conspiracy begins in the very palace of the sovereign lady of our ocean isle. Leal and loyal as it is the proud vaunt of the Bleeder's readers, one and all, to be, the inhabitant who pens this exposure does not personally impeach, either Her Majesty the Queen, or the illustrious Prince Consort. But, some silken-clad smoothers, some purple parasites, some fawners in frippery, some greedy and beggartered ones in gorgeous garments, he does impeach, and wrathfully. Is it asked on what grounds? They shall be stated. The Bleeder's London correspondent, in the prosecution of his important inquiries, goes down to Windsor, sends in his card, has a confidential interview with Her Majesty and the illustrious Prince Consort. For a time, the restraints of royalty are thrown aside in the cheerful conversation of the Bleeder's London correspondent, in his fund of information, in his flow of anecdote, in the atmosphere of his genius. Her Majesty brightens, the illustrious Prince Consort thaws, the cares of state and the conflicts of party are forgotten, lunch is proposed. Over that unassuming and domestic table, Her Majesty communicates to the Bleeder's London correspondent that it is her intention to send His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales to inspect the top of the Great Pyramid, thinking it likely to improve his acquaintance with the views of the people. Her Majesty further communicates that she has made up her royal mind, and that the Prince Consort has made up his illustrious mind, to the bestowal of the vacant garter, let us say on Mr. Roebuck. The younger royal children having been introduced at the request of the Bleeder's London correspondent, and having been by him closely observed to present the usual external indications of good health, the happy knot is severed. With a sigh, the royal bow is once more strung to its full tension. The Bleeder's London correspondent returns to London, writes his letter, and tells the Tetlesnivel Bleeder what he knows. All Tetlesnivel reads it, and knows that he knows it. But, does His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales ultimately go to the top of the Great Pyramid? Does Mr. Roebuck ultimately get the garter? No. Are the younger royal children even ultimately found to be well? On the contrary, they have, and on that very day had the measles. Why is this? Because the conspirators against the Bleeder's London correspondent have stepped in with their dark machinations. Because Her Majesty and the Prince Consort are artfully induced to change their minds, from north to south, from east to west, immediately after it is known to the conspirators that they have put themselves in communication with the Bleeder's London correspondent. It is now indignantly demanded, by whom are they so tampered with? It is now indignantly demanded, who took the responsibility of concealing the indisposition of those royal children from their royal and illustrious parents, and of bringing them down from their beds, disguised, expressly to confound the London correspondent of the Tetlesnivel Bleeder? Who are those persons, it is again asked. Let not rank and favor protect them. Let the traitors be exhibited in the face of day. Lord John Russell is in this conspiracy. Tell us not that his lordship is a man of too much spirit and honor. Denunciation is hurled against him. The proof? The proof is here. The time is panting for an answer to the question, will Lord John Russell consent to take office under Lord Palmerston? Good. The London correspondent of the Tetlesnivel Bleeder is in the act of writing his weekly letter, finds himself rather at a loss, to settle this question finally, leaves off, puts his hat on, goes down to the lobby of the House of Commons, sends in for Lord John Russell, and has him out. He draws his arm through his lordship's, takes him aside, and says, John, will you ever accept office under Palmerston? His lordship replies, I will not. The Bleeder's London correspondent retorts, with the caution such a man is bound to use, John, think again, say nothing to me rashly. Is there any temper here? His lordship replies, calmly, none whatever. After giving him time for reflection, the Bleeder's London correspondent says, once more, John, let me put a question to you. Will you ever accept office under Palmerston? His lordship answers, note the exact expressions, nothing shall induce me ever to accept a seat in a cabinet, of which Palmerston is the chief. They part. The London correspondent of the Tetlesnivel Bleeder finishes his letter, and always being withheld by motives of delicacy, from plainly divulging his means of getting accurate information on every subject, at first hand puts in it this passage. Lord John Russell is spoken of, by blunderers, for foreign affairs. But I have the best reasons for assuring your readers that, giving prominence to the exact expressions, it will be observed, nothing will ever induce him to accept a seat in the cabinet, of which Palmerston is the chief. Apostrophe on this, you may implicitly rely. What happens? On the very day of the publication of that number of the Bleeder, the malignity of the conspirators, being even manifested in the selection of the day Lord John Russell takes the Foreign Office, comment were superfluous. The people of Tetlesnivel will be told, have been told, that Lord John Russell is a man of his word. He may be, on some occasions, but, when overshadowed by this dark and enormous growth of conspiracy, Tetlesnivel knows him to be otherwise. I happen to be certain, deriving my information from a source which cannot be. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.